Mijn opa heeft gekozen voor euthanasie. Klinkt misschien gek, maar als het zover is, wil ik dat ook.
This is part of a Dutch media campaign for the Right to Die group NVVE. A teenage girl says, my grandpa chose euthanasia this year. And it might sound strange, but when the time comes, I want that too. Don't worry, says the voice at the end. It's dead normal. And in the Netherlands, it is. I'm Liz Carr, and welcome to part two of this BBC series. I'm visiting every place in the world where it's legal, under certain circumstances, to ask someone to kill you. There are two ways of doing it. You can ask a doctor to give you a prescription or the fatal drugs, but you have to administer them yourself, assisted suicide. Or you can ask for euthanasia, which means a doctor will give you the lethal medication. I'm making this trip as a campaigner who's against the legalisation of both assisted suicide and euthanasia. Not for religious or right-to-life reasons, but because I don't think we can pass a law to help the few who want to end their lives that will fully safeguard those who don't want to die. And so I want to visit the countries which have a law and find out if I'm right to be worried or not. This week, I'm starting off in the Netherlands, the country where it seems everything is legal. Valberg de Jong from the Right to Die organisation NVVE told me why.
Maybe we are rather pragmatic. We discuss things rather in the open. And of course, the church doesn't have much influence on it. You see that more and more people are choosing how to live, how to fill in your life, that they also want to say, well, I couldn't ask to be born, but at the end I want to have a good death and I want to choose that in my way. And I believe that the baby boomers, I'm one of those baby boomers, say at the end I want to say this is enough and I want to choose my own death.
Euthanasia and assisted suicide are both legal in the Netherlands. So you can either ask your doctor to give you a lethal injection or get a prescription for a liquid drug you take yourself. But in both cases, the doctor has to be present. And in most cases, it's your family doctor.
First of all, there must be a voluntary and well-considered request of the patient. Secondly, there must be an unbearable and hopeless suffering. That's the most difficult. Unbearable suffering is the most difficult one. There are no reasonable alternatives anymore. There must be a second opinion of another doctor, an independent doctor. And of course, the doctor has to do with the right medicine.
About 3,000 people died through euthanasia last year, about 3% of total deaths, a number which increases each year. They're mainly cancer patients, but the latest discussion in the Netherlands is about extending the law to another group of people, the over 70s, who may not be ill or dying, but who are simply tired of life, or as NVVE call it, people who have reached a completed life.
There is a group of rather well-known Dutch people, and they say, well, everyone above 70 should have this choice, whether you're healthy or not healthy. So also when I'm a healthy person, when I'm saying it's done, this life, then I must have the right to leave this life.
Completed life is going to be the next major debate in relation to assisted suicide and euthanasia in the Netherlands. But someone who will be opposed to it is Henk Reitsma. And like so many on each side of the debate, his views have been forged from personal experience.
It was in January of 1996 that my grandfather, who at that time had been in an old people's home for about 5 years, he was given a treatment of a kind of morphine overdose and in the last days withholding of hydration and food, which was called versterving back then. It was a kind of a verb made out of the word to deify somebody, you might say in English. And this was something that had not been discussed with the family. The family discovered what was going on when an aunt of mine, the day before my grandfather died, was giving him some water with a swab, and one of the nurses told her, don't do that, you're prolonging his death. And this was the moment that we discovered that they were treating with the intent to end life. My grandfather was not directly terminally ill, he was still lucid. My grandfather was a rather conservative Christian, and so it was the most horrifying thought that his life would have been ended prematurely.
Although Henk's grandfather didn't die under the Dutch euthanasia law, he worries that voluntary procedures open the door to involuntary ones.
They normalise thinking about it as one of the options. We were already talking about a good number of involuntary deaths in the Netherlands. In the formalized statistics, there are at least 300 involuntary euthanasias a year, which are just formally reported here. And the figures of involuntary, let's say, ending of life with some form of apt palliation, as in the case of my grandfather, is probably, a manifold that. So, yeah, when you open the door to the voluntary, you open a door to attitudes that bring a whole lot of vulnerability for those who are weak and suffering.
After an early start, I'm now in The Hague for a conference run by the Right to Die organisation NVVE about an initiative that they launched in March 2012. So I've just got my press pack, I've got my free pencil, and on the desk there was also some Right to Die mints. Right to Die breath mints or Right to Die death mints? Not sure. The conference was about an initiative that hit the news around the world last year for mobile euthanasia units, or as the headlines called them, death vans.
What we see is sometimes people can fulfill the criteria of the law, or the doctors can fulfill the criteria, but they have a doctor who doesn't want to do it. And that's why we took the initiative for this clinic.
When the, how do you say it again, Leven's Eine Klinik, when that first came into the headlines around the world, it was usually followed by pictures of VW camper vans and vehicles or ambulances, black ambulances or whatever, heading to people's houses and killing people.
Yeah.
Is it not like that?
No, it's not like that.
I don't know whether I'm excited about that or disappointed. I'm not sure.
You like the black cars.
I like the ideas of the vehicles, I'll be honest, yes.
Yeah. Well, there are cartoons made about it, yes. It's not a van. No, people die in their own bed when possible.
So the Leven's Eine Klinik was set up to send doctors out to patients when their own doctor is not happy to participate in euthanasia. This could be for religious or moral reasons, but research shows that it's more likely for complicated cases, where the patient isn't terminally ill and the doctor is having difficulty deciding if the patient is experiencing intolerable suffering. For example, people with dementia, disability or a psychiatric condition. Constanze Vries-Eggers is one of the clinic's doctors.
When a doctor don't want to do an euthanasia in normal practice and the patient has stomach cancer, then the patient will die anyway. But in the population of the Leven's Eine Kliniek, sometimes psychiatry, sometimes neurological disease, you won't die from some neurological diseases, but you have to hope that somebody could help you if you want an euthanasia.
How does it feel to be part of the process of ending someone's life? As a doctor, those last moments of maybe killing someone, euthanizing them, how does that feel?
It's a very special process. I compare it with birth. When the baby is born, it's a fantastic emotional scenery. And when somebody is dying, it's a fantastic emotional scenery. But I don't like to do it so every day, every week. No, I have a limit. I can't do more than 6 in a year emotionally.
In the Netherlands, both assisted suicide and euthanasia are available for competent children over 12, as well as adults who are terminally ill or experiencing intolerable suffering, increasingly for those who have dementia and psychiatric conditions, and in the future, perhaps for anyone over 70 who is tired of life. So is it the case that once you introduce assisted suicide and euthanasia for one group, that it's naturally extended to others and that the numbers increase? People talk about a slippery slope in relation to assisted suicide and euthanasia, and I'm worried that that's what it actually means, that once a law's in, it's much easier to extend it. So now seems like the perfect time for the final leg of my trip to the west coast of America, where there are two states where assisted suicide is legal, but they're very clear that it's only legal for those who are terminally ill. I'm here in Oregon, the first state in the US to legalize assisted suicide with their Death with Dignity Act in 1994. I'm actually here in Portland in Pioneer Square, totally appropriate place to be because Oregonians pride themselves on being pioneers, on leading the way, on having no state intervention over their lives and being not just liberal but libertarian in their way of life. So maybe it's unsurprising that they were the first state to introduce such a law. I'm going to meet people on both sides of the debate, those who supported the law and work with it, and those who remain opponents and have concerns about legalizing assisted suicide.
We see people who think of aid in dying not as a way to destroy themselves, but as a way to preserve themselves, to validate the whole person whom they are. People say, my death is approaching, it is imminent, I can see it. I will die still as whole person as I can be.
This is Barbara Coombs Lee, head of Compassion and Choices, one of the organisations behind the implementation of the Death with Dignity Act. In the USA, you'll hear a lot about death with dignity and aid in dying. On this side of the argument, they don't agree with the term assisted suicide.
Assisting a suicide is a felony in Oregon. Nothing about the Oregon Death with Dignity Act changed that felony. So the law makes a clear distinction between a medical practice that offers aid to a person who is in the final stage of a terminal illness and is seeking a way to make their death as peaceful for themselves, as peaceful for their family as possible. That is a rational decision. It is not the result of disordered thinking or suicidal ideation. It's deserving of respect.
The law came in through a voter initiative, much like a referendum. The first vote was a close 51-49 win for the proponents of the law. The opposition, headed by the Catholic Church, took out an injunction against the voter initiative, which meant it was back on the ballot papers in 1997. There were massive opposition campaigns to repeal the law, but the second time round, the initiative allowing assisted suicide passed by a landslide. Barbara Coombs Lee explains.
I think Oregon voters understood, and they were so irate that their elected officials had done this to them and made them vote a second time, that that time it was a landslide rejection. The voters speak. Don't try and undo what we said.
But not everyone in Oregon is happy with the law. Physicians for Compassionate Care is a campaign group opposed to death with dignity.
The problem of assisted suicide is that what once used to be a cry for help, we just ignore. And now we say, well, how can I help you? And so instead of giving them help, we, you know, help them along.
And when you think about that paradigm, if I respond in that way, I'm really saying whether you live or die really doesn't matter to me. I'm like a vending machine, and your wish is my command, whatever you want. Pull the left lever, I'll help you to live. Pull the right lever, I'll help you to die.
They think that death with dignity isn't something that they, as doctors, ought to be doing.
Direct and intentional medical killing is always dangerous, and it puts at risk vulnerable populations. It harms this thing that we try to do with our patients, this relationship. And if they wanted to do this, if they wanted to allow veterinarians to kill patients here in Oregon, let's just say that. Now, that's a facetious argument. But if they wanted to do it, it'd make more sense to
me. Well, it would, because they're already trained in it. It was part of their education. What are we going to do? We're going to create time in medical schools where we teach people how to kill people? Because we don't do that now.
The Oregon law applies to competent adults who have a terminal illness resulting in less than 6 months to live. Two doctors must approve the request before they give the patient a lethal prescription for the 100 tablets that you must take to end your life. Once the prescription has been given, you're on your own. You may have a volunteer from Compassion and Choices or even a doctor present, but there's no requirement for anyone to be there with you or witness the actual assisted suicide, and no limit to how long you may keep the prescription for. Many people who get the prescription never take it. Just knowing they've got the option is enough.
Do you think that there is a type of person that you see? You know, these people are probably the most studied population of people availing themselves of any medical practice in the history of the world. And yes, there's a pattern. The pattern is more likely to be highly educated. So these are people who have lived pretty full, satisfying, wonderful lives. People who have felt in control of the circumstances of their lives and probably unwilling to let the circumstances of their death fall to some roll of the dice.
But Chuck Bentz and William Toffler from Physicians for Compassionate Care see it slightly differently.
What we found here is that these are the people who, most of them are, I think, more Caucasian, highly educated, not even really that sick yet, just sort of wanting to make a political statement. Or
it's a white worried well.
It's people who want a great deal of control in their lives.
And don't want disability.
And study.
They abhor disability.
The Oregon Public Health Division's most recent report on the Death with Dignity Act seems to confirm this. The majority of people using the act do so not because of concerns about pain or pain control, but instead about being less able to engage in activities making life enjoyable, losing autonomy, and loss of dignity. These concerns have as much to do with disability as they do terminal illness, which perhaps is why disabled people like me see assisted death as relevant to them. Marilyn Golden works with a campaign group called Not Dead Yet.
We have to ask, do people with disabilities have true choice and self-determination in terms of living outside of nursing homes, in terms of housing that is truly affordable and accessible, which is in very short supply in my country here in the United States, in terms of the kind of services that really allow them to lead meaningful lives? In many cases, no. And we have had to fight tooth and nail to just get a minimal level of service. If your life is so miserable because you don't have the kind of true choice and self-determination that the disability movement is fighting for, that your choice is to die, that's a phony form of freedom.
The Oregon law is often used as a blueprint for other countries and states considering introducing such a law. So far in the USA, only Washington State has followed suit, enacting its Death with Dignity Act after a ballot initiative in 2008.
My mother loved, she loved life. But after her cancer spread to her bones and vital organs, she decided to use Oregon's Death with Dignity law.
Hello, I'm Martin Sheen with a message about Initiative 1000. It's a dangerous idea that could be imposed on the poor, disabled, and most vulnerable in our society.
Passing a Death with Dignity law in Washington would put decisions about easing pain and suffering in the hands of terminally ill patients like Randy and not in the hands of the government, politicians, and religious leaders.
When she went, it was how she lived, with her dignity.
Vote yes on I-1000, Death with Dignity.
I'm urging you to vote no on Initiative 1000. Thank you.
Rob Miller is head of Compassion and Choices in Washington State.
The law is, in Washington is almost an exact copy of the Oregon law, and that was an important part of the campaign because the Oregon law had been in existence for over a decade at the time, I believe, and the safety of the law had been well established over and over again during the campaign here. We referred to the Oregon law and the experience in Oregon as a way to counter the arguments of the opposition, which there was no way for them to document their opposition. They had no studies, no data. It was really a fear-based campaign on the part of the opponents.
While the passion and the polarization of this debate seem to be the same from state to state and country to country, what makes the USA different is its lack of socialized health care.
The Oregon Health Plan says no to chemotherapy and yes to assisted suicide.
Like my doctor said, maybe this can put the lid on it and stop it.
In a letter to a Eugene cancer patient, the state explains it will not cover the cost of her chemo, but it will pay for doctor-assisted suicide.
Is it cheaper to pay for somebody to die than to help them live?
The case of Oregon resident Barbara Wagner hit the news in 2008. William Toffler of Physicians for Compassionate Care takes up the story.
Isn't this an absolute dangerous cocktail when you actually have cost pressures trying to limit access to care? At the same time, you now have the suicide solution. And of course, that was best exemplified by the case that made it in international news here in Oregon of Barbara Wagner, who had recurrent cancer. Her oncologist wanted her to have Tarceva made by Genentech. It's not an experimental treatment. It had been out for about 10 years. It wouldn't cure her, likely, but it would give her a 45% increased chance of being alive in 1 year. And in a letter from the state of Oregon, she was told that, well, we can't cover the Tarceva because your prognosis is less than 5% chance of being alive in 5 years. So we won't cover that, but we'll pay fully for palliative care, including assisted suicide, 100%.
The letter Barbara Wagner received listed about 10 options, and yes, one of those options was aid in dying under the Oregon Death with Dignity Act.
Barbara Coombs Lee of Compassion and Choices Oregon. She says that the drug Barbara Wagner could have received was an experimental treatment which wouldn't have significantly lengthened her life, but the case still turned into a PR nightmare for Compassion and Choices.
People don't receive that letter anymore. The Oregon Health Plan decided that was a poor letter to send. It was psychologically a poor idea, and so no, people don't receive that letter anymore. They are still advised of their options to palliative and hospice care, though.
But Barbara Wagner's case still raises important questions about what treatments we pay for, when to stop treatment, who makes these choices, particularly in a country like the USA, where one of the major causes of bankruptcy is terminal illness. Do people always end their lives out of choice, or is it because of no choice? Kenneth Stevens from Physicians for Compassionate Care introduced me to one of his patients who once believed she had no choice.
I'm Jeanette Hall, a patient of Dr. Ken Stevens. I had anal cancer. I, at the time, had voted for suicide. I was for it, but as I went through and he talked me out of what my intention was, it brought me full circle to be 12 years survivor. I am not for assisted suicide. There's more to life than to end it too soon. Beautiful day here on a sunroof, and it's great to be alive, and I have changed my opinion.
So that's it. We've reached the end of the series, and I'm still alive. Jeanette changed her opinion, did I? Well, in many of the places we visited, I've sipped my drinks rather cautiously, and I'm definitely glad to be coming home to the UK, a country which doesn't have an assisted suicide law, but which does have legal guidance for those who help someone to end their life. All the people I've met have been so willing to share their points of view and personal stories. In fact, the passion people feel about this issue seems to me directly in proportion to their personal experiences. And maybe that's why I don't want it legalised, because of my personal experiences of the medical profession. For example, a friend of mine had a do not resuscitate order placed on her in intensive care, against her will. The doctor didn't think her life was worth living because she was disabled. Thankfully, she was resuscitated, and now she sits in the British House of Lords. If the medical profession has such low expectations of our lives, can we trust them with such life and death decisions? But once you move this debate away from the personal stories and experiences, you're ultimately left with two simple questions. Can the state regulate medical killing? And should it? After all the places I visited, I haven't changed my mind. The answer for me is still no.